What's up, Dream Warriors? So welcome back to another episode of our podcast on Elm Street. I'm Mark.
And I'm Brooke.
And this week, we are coming at you guys with part three of our Scream in September, which means we are talking about 2000's installment in the Scream franchise, Scream 3.
Yes.
We're traveling all the way to Hollywood to talk about this movie. And we have another guest on, a different guest than our first episode, but definitely not a new guest to the podcast. So introducing Chuck from Chuck and Ruff Go to the Movies.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, man. How are you doing?
I'm happy to be here. We're talking about one of the best horror franchises that exists. So, I mean, you could be talking about the best movie in the franchise. You could be talking about the worst movie in the franchise, and it's still a great time. So I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, and that line right there is why we brought you on to talk about these movies. We had to get people on that shared the same love and adoration for this franchise as us.
It's an absolutely fantastic franchise. I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves here. I know we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this, but I mean, it just really is. It's just a wonderful franchise from beginning to end. I mean, it's brilliant beyond brilliant. Kevin Williamson created an entire world that is just absolutely wonderful to dive into. So I very much look forward to picking this apart a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those franchises that you can watch repeatedly and not get sick and tired of it.
Absolutely.
Now, a lot of people have issues with this installment, so I'm excited to hear your guys' thoughts on it all. I have my own thoughts, obviously, but we'll talk about all that later on. But in the meantime, what have you guys been watching recently that's been worth mentioning?
I guess I'll go first if Mark is letting me this time.
Yeah, you go right ahead.
Not too much this week. I watched, I finished Temple of Doom.
Nice.
Great movie.
Yeah, love it. Then I decided to watch Coco, and it still is probably top two for me, honestly. Mm-hmm. Just it's a beautiful movie. The ending still makes me cry. God damn. Watch Tropic Thunder. Haven't watched it in a while. Wanted to see if it held up at all. And Downey Jr.'s performance is the only reason why this movie holds up for me.
We have been quoting that movie at work so much lately. It's fantastic. It's got some great one-liners.
It's so funny. Then today I watched, because the Amazon Prime tackled the remake of the Austrian film Goodnight Mommy, and I had never seen the original, so I decided to give it a watch before I watched the remake of it, and I really liked it. I thought it was fantastic.
It's so weird that they would make a remake less than 10 years from the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Well, America's got to get their hands on it, right?
Yeah, and then I watched the remake. It was not good. Not good at all, and it's kind of funny because Naomi Watts, she's in this one, and she was also in the remake of Funny Games, which was also another remake that came out, like, I think way less than 10 years after the original, and I didn't like the remake, but yeah.
She was also in the remake of The Ring.
Yeah.
That's true, yeah.
She's the remake trend queen. Here.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't like the Funny Games remake either.
No, me, no, I didn't, no.
Yeah.
No. But yeah, it's a pretty short week this week. Yeah. Watched too much.
Yeah, we just recorded last Wednesday, so haven't had a whole lot of time to...
Yeah, I had a wedding to go to, you know, so... Mm-hmm. How about you guys?
Chuck, I'll let you go ahead.
I have to sit here and think. I'm like, you know, Robert and I have the same discussion on our podcast, and I'm just like, well, I haven't watched anything new, but y'all don't know that. So I've been really getting into the House of the Dragon, obviously. We talk about it in the group chat. The Rings of Power, just phenomenal shows. I'm very excited to see where they're going. As far as movies are concerned, I really haven't watched anything new. I watched something that was new to me, but it came out in 2004. Garden State. It's one of my brother's favorite movies, and I've never gotten around to watching it until this last week. And I have to say, it's a depressing ass movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is that but Natalie Portman's finest performance?
Is that quite honestly. Zach Braff in it? Okay, yeah.
I liked it. It's a really depressing movie. And then let's see, what else have I watched? That's it. I've just been watching like a lot of documentaries and stuff like that. Like I've really been going through the Netflix, the movies that made us.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really enjoying those. So that's about it.
Netflix has been pumping out the documentaries lately. Like all the true crime documentaries that are on there now.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
There's one that's on there that I just saw the other day. I can't remember what it was called, but it looks really good. I want to watch it. They just added it. As for me, I haven't watched anything since our last discussion.
Busy nothing. Lives.
Well, I was sitting here and I'm like, I had baseball Thursday night, and then Friday night, I think I was playing a video game, so I didn't watch a movie. And then last night we had that wedding that we had to go to, and here we are.
Y'all were looking all dapper.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Not a problem.
I mean, I watch the Office is my go-to show. Like if I want to laugh, if I want to feel good, it helps me go to sleep. It's just my show. So like I've watched a few episodes of that, like while falling asleep kind of thing, but that's pretty much it. But yeah, so pretty boring week for me. There's been a lot of movies that I've wanted to go back and rewatch that I've kind of, well, I've seen them, but like haven't seen them in a while. And Brooke, you're watching of Indiana Jones Temple of Doom. Like that is like, I want to go back and rewatch that franchise because it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
Chuck, you guys just did Event Horizon, and I just watched that like last year, but like I really want to go back and rewatch it again after I saw that you guys did it. I was like, oh man, this movie's so good.
I encourage as many rewatches of that movie as possible.
Seriously. And it's a terrifying movie.
It is.
Yeah. Just something about space, right?
Everything about space is terrifying. Hell, I mean, Star Trek can be a terrifying, movie to watch. I mean, space is scary, man. That's why I always have panic attacks every time I watch Gravity, but I love that movie so much. So, just like I'll suffer through the panic attacks.
Yeah. It's like, I just started, well, the game that I was playing Friday night, I just found it on my PlayStation. Yeah. It's called Deliver Us the Moon. And was it on my Xbox? I can't remember. Anyways, regardless. And you're an astronaut that goes out to try and save like a lost expedition that went out to kind of colonize the moon. And it just like everything's super realistic. Like you actually have to push all the buttons to get the shuttle to like take off. And then once you get up into space, you're in zero gravity. So you're like floating around and trying to like get a whole bunch of stuff figured out and fixed and whatnot. So it's not a scary game by any means, but at the same time, it's like, it's very good at making you feel that claustrophobia and the sense of like aloneness.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Yeah, it's cool. Check
that
it out.
That sounds like a fun game.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. All right. Well, if that's everything, then I guess we can dive into this movie. These intros just keep getting shorter and shorter lately. After our first one, Brooke and I, because we hadn't recorded in like 3 weeks, so our Scream intro was just, it was like 25 minutes of like, yeah, we watched like 75 movies combined in the last 3 weeks. But, yeah. All right, so let's cue that theme music and we'll start talking about this movie. All right, like we said in the intro, this week we're talking about Scream 3 from the year 2000. This is obviously the third installment in the Scream franchise and the third installment of our Scream in September episodes. We're joined by Jeffrey Chuck Norris. I'm just going to say Chuck Norris.
There you go.
from Chuck and Ruff Go to the Movies. Chuck, before we start talking about this, do you want to plug your podcast a little bit? Normally, I would ask you to do that in the intro, but I forgot, so we'll do it now.
That's okay. Yes, like you said, I am Jeffrey Chuck Norris. I am one half of the hosting group that does Chuck and Ruff Goes to the Movies. It's me and my brother. We just we talk about movies, whether we like them or not. We've had a couple of discussions where I don't like the movie or he doesn't like the movie, but they're still fun discussions to have. And yeah, that's basically the premise. The whole idea was, you know, that's what we used to do on the phone, is just talk about movies, talk about movies. I launched the podcast all the way back in, what was that, 2020? Yeah, February 2020 is when we started. And then he joined me full time a couple seasons later. And we've just been having a ball, and we're just going to keep doing it until we get tired of talking about movies or we run out. Whenever that happens,
you can run out of movies. Holy cow.
I know. Yeah, that's never going to happen. Never going to happen. We're on all the major platforms. So go check us out. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So hit us up.
Nice. Thank you. All right. I saw you put down your bottle of beer or something whenever I asked you to do that. So what are you drinking tonight?
Well, I don't drink anymore, believe it or not, guys. So this is a very special occasion for me that I'm going to crack this open. It's a Yuengling Oktoberfest. I've cut most alcohol and soda out of my life, but, you know, every once in a while is for a festive occasion. It's okay to have one, and this is a festive occasion. So that's what I am drinking.
Awesome.
Nice.
Sounds good. What about you, Brooke?
I'm drinking a Flying Monkeys, Theater of Madness pumpkin beer. So, you know, had to grab those October beers. Mm-hmm. What was you, Mark?
I got too drunk at the wedding last night, so I didn't leave my couch for most of the day today. So I'm drinking the last beer that I have in my fridge, which is just a plain old boring Coors Light.
Nothing wrong with that.
It's always good to stay hydrated with water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Funny, I say the same thing to my wife all the time, because she's always like, oh, you got to drink water if you're going to be drinking a lot of alcohol. And I'll be like, well, there's water in beer, so that's all I need.
Big ingredient.
Yeah. And I drink a lot of vodka sodas, so that's water too. Stay hydrated while getting intoxicated.
Stay hydrated, my friends.
All right, let's talk about this movie. We'll start off with a synopsis, as always. While Sydney and her friends visit the Hollywood set of Stab 3, the third film based on the Woodsboro murders, another Ghostface killer rises to terrorize them. I have issues with this synopsis.
Yeah.
Oh, what part of it?
It makes it sound like Sydney and her friends planned this Hollywood trip to the set of Stab 3. Yeah. No, that's not how this movie happened.
No.
Sydney wasn't even there until the last bit.
Yeah. Sydney gets called to the set in order to help them catch the killer who is ravaging through the set. But yeah. And which leads me to the question that I asked Josh earlier. This movie is Stab 3, but it's using the set from the events that would have happened in Stab.
It's all meta. So
yeah,
what it's doing, and I actually had some thoughts about this when we talk about story and quality and things like that. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is meta is that they're supposed to be calling back to the events of the original Stab movie or the original Scream movie in this case. And that's what it's relying on to get its relevancy in the franchise. So that is why the set is the way it is. That's essentially all this movie is. It just wants to remind you that, hey, we exist in this franchise and they're just going to keep shoving it in our face and shoving it in our face and shoving it in our face until we're sick of it. So I think that's kind of what makes this movie.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on all that, Brooke?
Well, actually, I have a problem with the movie poster.
Okay.
Because with the other two movies, they had the main opening person kill on the cover of the movies. Now, I think maybe you should have maybe swapped out Tyson, or I think Elizabeth is her name, for Cotton Weary, I think.
Yeah.
Some people are like, oh, Cotton's in the story somehow. You know, they brought him back in the story, but...
Yeah, they kind of do change the format, eh?
Yeah.
To throw you off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see Cotton have a bigger part in this movie. I like that they killed him off, but I would have liked to see him have a bit of a bigger part.
Yeah, he needed to go. I think his storyline was definitely coming to a close. I think it came to a close at the end of Scream 2. But if you're going to bring him back, you know, don't bring him back just to kill him off immediately. Give him a little bit of heart. Give him, like, make us believe he's going to be doing something absolutely amazing before you off him. And then, you know, just kind of lure us into that false sense of security.
Yeah. I love the title of his talk show, though. 100% Cotton. All right, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that's okay. This movie was directed by the one and only Wes Craven. We've already talked about him in our first two episodes, so we don't need to do a deep dive into him again. And as for the cast, we have our original three. As always, we have Neve Campbell playing Sydney, Courtney Cox playing Gail Weathers, and David Arquette playing Dewey. We also have another slew of big-name actors from the late 90s and early 2000s.
Before we go to that, I was going to ask Chuck, because he hadn't really had a chance to speak on it. What do you have any thoughts on, like, the main three cast for Wes Craven that you wanted to mention or talk about?
No, not really, except for the fact that all the way back to Scream, the original... This was an odd casting that, in my mind, should have never worked, quite honestly. You've got Neve Campbell, big TV star. You've got David Arquette, who's quirky as hell. And then Courtney Cox. Come on. But it worked. And I love seeing the three of them just come together. Every movie, their interactions are just get richer and richer and richer. And of course, let's not forget the true star of Scream 3 right now, Courtney Cox's bangs.
Oh my God. I was going to bring up the first part of the discussion.
No, I love seeing these three together. They're absolutely wonderful to see together. And I'm actually kind of sad that moving forward, Neve Campbell is not going to be there. And spoiler alert, neither is David Arquette.
Yeah.
But it's just fun to watch them while we can. And it's such a great pairing. And as far as the actors individually themselves, I don't have anything to add on to them. And of course, Wes Craven, may he rest in peace. Just one of the most iconic horror directors of all time, and despite weak stories, he can still manage to put out a few bangers here and there, and this, you know, his involvement in the Scream franchise were definitely bangers.
Definitely. Yeah, Courtney Cox's bangs are almost as bad as Josh Hartnett's hair in what movie is that, The Faculty. Was it The Faculty that it was really bad? Yeah.
Another Kevin Williamson film.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, like I said, we have a whole new slew of names that are recognizable. Starting off with Patrick Dempsey, who plays Kincaid. He is most notable for playing McDreamy in Grey's Anatomy. he's also in Enchanted, Transformers, Dark of the Moon, and Sweet Home Alabama. I have Parker Posey, who played Jennifer. She is in Dazed and Confused. I can't fucking stand her character in that movie. That's her character's the worst part of the movie for me, and it's like it's one of my favorite movies. She just drives me crazy. The whole like air raid scene drives me nuts. She's also in Blade Trinity, Superman Returns, excuse me, and Lost in Space. Next is a big name in horror movies, Lance Henriksen, who played Milton. He's in Aliens, Alien vs. Predator, Pumpkinhead, The Quick and the Dead, and the video game The Quarry that just came out this year. Mm. And lastly, I have Scott Foley, who played Roman. He's a big TV actor. He's in The Unit, Felicity, Scandal, True Bloods, and Grey's Anatomy as well.
And was famously married to Jennifer Garner.
Oh, that's right.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch of honorable mentions.
I was about to say, there's definitely a lot of honorable mentions in this one.
Yeah. I only wrote down five because I'm assuming there's going to be some more from you guys. I had to start it off with Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
They had a very, very small part, but they were there. So I have to put their names down in their iconic roles of Jay and Silent Bob. Carrie Fisher was in it for a brief moment. Patrick Warburton, who is one of the best voice actors of all time, in my opinion.
Yes.
And I have Jenny McCarthy Wahlberg.
Yeah.
She's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Yes, she is. She's perfect for Donnie.
Yeah.
All right. I know you guys have some, so let's hear them.
I had Dion Richmond, who played Tyson.
Yeah.
He's most recognizable from Hatchet and also Not Another Teen Movie.
Yeah.
Playing the token black guy.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Y'all covered all of them, so I have nothing to add to that.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
I mean, Jamie Kennedy, but I mean,
yeah,
we'll talk about that one later on.
I also saw that he's in archived footage, so never mind. I was going to say Matthew Lillard makes an appearance again, but it doesn't really count if it's archived footage.
Yeah, you can't count that one. He didn't actually show up to set and film anything. It's not like Scream 2, where he's in the background of the party, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, you guys ready to talk about this movie?
Let's do it.
Yes, sir.
Give a stab on.
Yeah. So the opening scene is our good old friend Cotton Weary, 100% cotton. and he's stuck in traffic. What did you guys think of the voice changer that the Ghostface has in this movie?
I think it's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
Personally, Chuck's giving a face, but like, I don't think it's realistic, but I think it's brilliant.
That's exactly it. While it's in all its brilliance, I think it's a sellout. It's a cop out. The whole idea of being able to disguise yourself as somebody else and stuff like that, just for the sake of fooling them. It served its purpose, but I'm just like, it was really, I hate to use this term when we talk about movies, blurring the lines of reality there. But I mean, it really was in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could agree, but I did kind of like it because it's like the third movie. They kind of change things a little bit. And spoiler, there was only one killer in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that we know of, I guess. But it's kind of harder for him to, be talking on the phone and doing the killing at the same time.
Yeah, and like he used it to his utmost advantage, right? Because he could lure anybody to wherever he wanted them to go. Like he pretended to be Dewey to get Sydney to go somewhere. He also pretended to be Maureen to fuck with Sydney. And I talk about that later on too. Like the mental torture that he put Sydney through in this movie is crazy, just by having Maureen's voice playing consistently throughout the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Question though, where did he get the voices? Like, where does he get Maureen's voice? I mean, she's been dead for a while. Where did he, when did he have time to collect all these voices?
The thing with oh, sorry, go ahead, bro.
Oh, I was just gonna say, like, starting off the movie when you hear the other voice and it switches, I had the same thoughts. I was like, okay, where does he get these voices? But I was like, I'm not gonna go down that road and just gonna, you know, turn that part off in my brain.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair because, yeah, you that just causes you to deconstruct the whole thing. And then you're just like, you don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But it is just one of those kind of ones that, you know, scratches at the back of my neck while I'm thinking, you know, watching the movie, especially that opening scene with Cotton Weary and you, you know, the killer's pretending to be Christine. Like, mm-hmm. Where did he get Christine's voice? Did he stalk her? Did he record so do you have to record a sample of the voice and then you can... So many questions.
Yeah, and this was like, in, you know, 99, you know, when they probably filmed this, it's like,
yeah,
they definitely, we might have the technology today to do that kind of thing, but
we can do deep fakes now, but I doubt we could replicate voices in 1999. I'm just saying.
That's kind of, yeah, like my thought process is like Cotton's voice, and like he's a director, right? So he could have archived footage of Maureen's movie roles. Where he could have gotten her voice, but it also, like, he also mentions that he went and saw Maureen and she turned him away. So he had been in Woodsboro, right? So he could have been planning this for that long and getting recordings of each character's voice and whatnot. But like, yeah, so I don't understand how he would be able to do it. Like, he would have to get like the pitch and connotation and everything like that of their voice. But yeah, it's 1999. I don't know if they had that sort of technology back then. But I mean, he's in Hollywood, so who knows? Maybe they did. They came up with the idea, so.
So many questions.
That's true. I did love this opening scene of like him stuck in traffic. He's like talking to the girl that called and then changed voices and then he's like still interested in talking to her, even though like he has a girl at home, you know?
Yeah. What a creep.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that whenever he like pulls away, smashes into someone, then when he gets home on the TV is like himself talking about how in LA there's these road ragers that are causing chaos. And he was just one of those road ragers.
Yeah. Do you think that person that he was talking to on the first call, do you think that was Ghostface?
That with like the voice changer, like the girl.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was talking to his agent.
No, because someone called and they were like
wrong number. Oh, sorry, yeah. Wrong number.
Like all that shit.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it was him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this kill like makes the most sense to me of like why Ghostface wants to kill this person.
He got famous off of being accused of something he was not in this whole idea of, you know, Maureen's murder and stuff like that. So yeah, it's kind of personal considering who the killer is in this movie. So yeah, it the kill makes sense. I just wish it happened later in the movie.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the whole point of these opening kill scenes in the Scream franchise. It's been a staple in the Scream franchise, except for the latest movie. You know, where you have that kind of like wow kill right at the beginning. So,
and spoiler alert for Scream 5, I'm happy that they didn't have that first kill in the movie.
Oh, I was so disappointed.
What? That's my girl, dude.
But
you've set a trend in the first four movies. You've had the kill, and then this one again, it subverts the expectations. So yeah, it was a very nice twist, but at the same time, I'm just like, now it doesn't feel like a Scream movie.
That's fair.
Where's the kill? Where's the kill?
Yeah, like if they would have done that in the first Scream, you know, when you go and see the movie and like Drew survives, say, and then after the movie, you're like, oh man, I'm so glad she survived. You know,
Drew's death was so, I'm still emotionally scarred from that. Like I did honestly never saw that coming. And that was the whole point, but yeah.
Yeah.
I'm emotionally scarred. I love me, Drew.
Jumping ahead in the future, with Scream 6, we have Samara Weaving, who has been confirmed to be in the movie. Do you think she's going to be their first kill?
No.
No? Do you think she's going to be in the movie?
I think honestly it's too think Courtney obvious. Cox.
Ooh.
Ooh. Okay.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why is she still there?
You've lost Dewey and you've lost Sydney. Hmm.
I think she's just going to get too brazen, too brave. You know, like she's the last one standing. Well, I mean, not literally the last one standing. Just I don't know what they're going to how they're going to treat the Sydney Prescott character at this point. But, you know, like Gail Weathers, you know, she's just finally pushed too far and somebody caught her at the weak moment. And I think that would make a lot of sense if she ends up being at least one of the first kills of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, and realistically, like, I think Sydney's the only one that could hold her own on her own. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Gail needs Sydney and Dewey. I think Dewey needs Sydney and Gail. Like, they're a trio, right? They kind of need each other and feed off each other. But I think Sydney is the only one that would be able to survive this on her own. I don't think Gail has the, I don't want to say she doesn't have the fight, but like she doesn't have the like all encompassing like final girl status that Neve Campbell has.
You hit it right there. That's it. She needs, she tries so hard to be the independent one, but she ends up needing or relying on the help of either, you know, Sydney or Dewey or sometimes other. In Scream 4, she was relying on high schoolers to help her out. I mean, come on. You know, she's not the independent one.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's jump back to Scream 3.
Yeah, sorry. Welcome to my show, guys. I go on tangents. Yeah, yeah.
No, you know,
I'm sorry. Good. I'm sorry. It's I'm good. Hijacking this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One question I had is why didn't Cotton just call the cops rather than keep trying to call his girlfriend?
You'd think he would have known after, you know, previous, you know, he may not have been a direct victim of, you know, in the previous two movies or anything like that, but he has knowledge. So, yeah, something seems off. Something seems crazy. Yeah. I would have just called the police, too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think he had a chance to kill Ghostface, but somehow he fucked it up. Like the bookcase was on top of him, goes to get the crowbar or whatever, and then just gets hit in the face with the bookshelf, and that's it.
Is that what happened? Because I was wondering, I'm like, how did he just like go flying backwards? Like, did Ghostface push the bookcase up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Smacked him in the face.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was like, there's no way Ghostface like was able to punch him that hard while underneath a bookcase. Okay, so he pushed the bookcase up. That makes sense.
Yeah. And I did like the scene whenever Cotton gets to his house, and I think Christine was her name, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's behind the door, and Ghostface is using that voice changer to make it seem like Cotton. And then when he gets there, she's like, get the fuck away from me. Like, you tried killing me. But I like the use of the voice changer in that scene, at least.
Yeah, I did too.
And y'all are absolutely right. And just the ability to do that makes the entire movie one big mind fuck. It really is just, it's a psychological, they've taken it to a psychological thriller at this point, or at least tried to.
So now we get to Sydney, and she's doing some crisis counseling. Do you think this is like volunteer work, or do you think this is what she went to college for?
Well, I think it's volunteer work. I think it seems like a job that would be volunteer based, like helping women in crisis, because she's been in crisis her whole life.
And besides, she's in isolation. She needs something, you know, some sort of interaction with somebody that isn't her, you know, the occasional visit from her father, you know. So, and I think she feels compelled to help other women because she was a woman in need at one point.
Yeah. Plus it helps her keep her anonymity too, right? Like, cause she changes her name while she's on these calls. She's Lauren, I think it is. And like, it's a private number that she's using. So like, it's harder for Ghostface to track her down, to contact her, in that regard.
And, Chuck, you already briefly mentioned it, but what the fuck is going on with Gail's, like, bands. Oh my god, they are so bad.
I just I have so many questions. Like, who in the wardrobe department decided, or, you know, makeup or whoever, hairstyle, who decided that, hey, Courtney, I've got an idea. And they rolled with it.
Just like, let me take this weed whacker and just go across your bands.
It's such a shame because, unfortunately, I don't feel like this about her anymore. But she was so attractive, you know, around that time period. In fact, I still maintain that Scream 2 was the peak of her attractiveness.
Yeah,
agreed. But I mean, it's just like, as soon as you did that, it's like, boom. I try not to be a superficial person here or anything like that, but my God, I mean, I'm sorry. I would have to turn away from that.
It was distracting.
It is. Like, I'd be trying to have a conversation with her and I'd just be looking at the bangs the whole time. Like, oh, can I shave your head? Yeah. Can I?
It would probably look better.
Yeah. Can I Jada Pinkett Smith your head here?
Yeah.
Sorry, Will Smith. I cannot keep her out of my mouth. Sorry.
Yeah.
Her bangs looked like, have you ever seen those videos where like the girls will like just like take all their bangs in one chunk and then just like do scissors across? That's what it looked like they did.
It reminded me when I was in middle school, I went to a Valentine's dance and my hair was out of control. So I decided to take it upon myself to kind of like trim it up. And oh my God, it looked awful. Took a long time to recover from that. So yeah, that's what it reminds me of. It's just like standing in front of a mirror one day, you know, she probably had a couple of cocktails like, oh, I can do this hair myself.
Yeah.
So bad. So bad. And then to get into a little bit of spoilers, I mean, if you haven't seen this movie, you know, it's been like 22 years, but Roman is a killer. do you think they gave it away too easily in this movie of who it was? I mean, there was a spoiler at the end with him being like the brother, but like rewatching it now, like the scene with Jenny McCarthy, like when he calls and he has the phone, I was like, That's him on the phone, right? It didn't seem like he was trying to hide the fact that.
But I mean, it could easily be played off that, you know, it was just Roman's voice on the recorder and, you know, the killer's fucking with Jenny McCarthy. Honestly, I don't think looking back on it now, I've seen the movie hundreds of times. Yeah. And yes, the clues were all there. But initially, no, I can't say that I feel like they gave it away too easily.
No, I don't think so either.
Cool. So how do you think he got this job on Stab 3? Do you think he's like a working director in the industry that, you know, has kind of made his name over the past, how long has it been since the first murders? Like 4 years?
Yeah.
Because it was two years in between and then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 96. Yeah, it's been roughly about 4, maybe 5 years. I don't know exactly what they were trying to establish in the timeline there. I think because he's the child, he's the product of another Maureen pairing long before she was Maureen Prescott and gave birth to Sydney. So, you know, he's old enough to be able to probably have already been established in some way, shape, or form in Hollywood, whether it's as a director, you know, in that business, you typically start out somewhere on the lower dregs and work your way up. That's probably how he campaigned to, you know, get this job. He has a pretty decent working relationship with the producer played by Lance Henriksen, you know, things like that. So that's probably, and of course, you know, that was part of his plan. You know, I have to get on to a Stab movie because that's how I'm going to execute the remainder of my plan.
Yeah.
I think, in my opinion, I think Stab 3 was supposed to be his big breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying like he didn't have, like, I'm not saying this is his first movie that he did, but just the way that he was going about making this movie and like, how he says like, oh, I got my movie out of this and like stuff like that. Like, I feel like this is supposed to be his like piece de resistance. Like, this was supposed to be his big break.
Remember, some of the best filmmakers in the world made some of the weirdest and crappiest movies. I'm looking at you, James Cameron. Piranha 3D.
Hey, come on now.
And now look at him. He has one of the highest gross, the highest grossing film of all time. So directors are up and coming.
Two of them in the top five too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, Avatar, Titanic. And yeah. They project Avatar 2 is going to get there, and I'm not holding my breath.
I'm not either.
It's going to drown at sea.
Yeah. And then Roman basically kills all of his actors in his movie. So I'm guessing he didn't pay for the movie.
Nope. That's all Milton.
So I got a question about that. So was the whole director thing an act then, or did he actually want to make it as a director? And if that's so, why would you kill off your cast? I mean, that's not exactly how you keep a movie going. And of course, you know, it's like he said, he's going to be cursed. Everybody's going to look at him. He's like, oh, that's the director of that failed Stab movie, you know, blah, 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 blah. Who's going to want to hire him? So was the whole directing thing an act just for his end game, or was he actually into it? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
I think he was actually into it because, like, Sydney wanted nothing to do with the other Stab movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like, how did he know that she was going to be a part of it? He kind of had to figure a way to get her onto the set of that movie somehow.
Mm-hmm.
How did he find her? So let's rewind to that. So to get her onto the set, he had to find her, make her feel uneasy in her isolation, and drive her out of isolation. Mm-hmm. And that's how she ended up in LA. That's how she ended up in Hollywood. And that's how she ended up on set. So the big question to that point is, how did he find her to begin with? Mm-hmm. So he could execute that part of the plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe he just thought he was going to get lucky and
started dialing numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
Started dialing all the women's crisis helplines in the area.
Who found the first photo of Maureen? Was it Dewey?
Gail or Dewey? I don't think
Dewey.
Yeah, I don't think it was the cop.
No.
I don't remember now.
Because he got the photos from the director, I think, right? Or not the director, the producer.
Yeah.
Because he knew Maureen.
Yeah, she'd worked with him before.
Which he denied until finally cornered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I have the movie on in the background here, so I'm looking to see if maybe we're at the part where the first picture arrives, but I think Dewey got it. I think Dewey did first.
Yeah. That makes sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the first kill here with, I forget what her name is in the movie, but Sarah?
Huh? Candy?
Candy.
No, Candy was her character in the movie and Stab she was playing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Sarah, maybe.
Oh, yeah, right, it is Sarah. Yeah.
Yeah, Sarah. What'd you think of her kill?
It was playful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was a replica of Rose McGowan's death. Like, she was halfway at the window, I think. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's what they're going for, but that's kind of what I took it as. Halfway at the window getting stabbed.
It was definitely unoriginal.
Yeah. Yeah, I talk about that in my face off there a little bit. But the thing I like about this movie a lot is the set. Because it's like a set on a set, right? And just seeing all the movie props, whenever she walks into the dressing room, all the ghost face costumes are there. And then you see the boot come off and picks up the rubber knife and all that. I thought it was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those horror movie cliches that kind of happens, you know, when you walk into a room, there's a bunch of mannequins and you don't under sheets and you don't know which one is, or if any of them or is actually a real person under a sheet. You walk into a room full of ghost face costumes. By the way, you have murders happening in the same pattern as Ghostface from that's already been established. why aren't we locking up the room with the Ghostface costumes and making it not as accessible to just anybody? I mean, come on. Bad security going on there.
That's a fair question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feel like it's just one of those things you walk in there and it's just like, I'm sorry, I would have seen all those Ghostface costumes and ran because I don't know if there's a person pretending to be hanging there on the rack.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so easy for the killer to hide in that room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I liked her death too. Then we get like the random Jay and Silent Bob cameo.
It's Connie fucking Chung.
Yeah.
Hey, say Connie, hi to Maury, how's Maury?
What do you think of Sid's nightmare dreams she was having in this movie?
Spoiler alert, the scariest thing in the entire movie. That's just that freaked me out. It still creeps me out to this day. It's one of the reasons I actually don't like looking out windows at night. You never know what's going to pop up in your window. But yeah, that was a creepy dream sequence.
It is creepy. Yeah. I mean, Wes Craven is the master of dream sequences, so it's only fitting that he made them terrifying.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think she was having these dreams in this? Because, like, I know I get why she might after, like, she sees the fucking bloody sheet and, like, Maureen's voice, but why do you think she was having them before?
I feel like these are just dreams that she has had since the events of Scream. But this is the first time that we're seeing them because it's the first time that they're being utilized to the killer's advantage.
Exactly.
So I feel like it's just like her psychological state of mind is just coming through in this movie.
Up until this point, we only needed to know that she was being haunted by the memory of her mother and the death and everything like that. Now it's being used as a tool to, again, help drive her out of isolation. So we need to see this dream happen to understand where her psyche is at this point.
Well, and does she not make reference to them like in the past two movies about like something about how she can't sleep where I feel like I'm remembering a line where she mentions having nightmares.
Yeah.
I could be wrong though.
She might.
I feel like she said it to either Tatum in the first movie or her roommate in the second movie. I honestly cannot remember, but I think I know what I think I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So now we are, I think, at Jennifer's house, I think. Jennifer's house, and then you get Steven, the bodyguard, out in like the trailer with Dewey and stuff. What do you think of Dewey's relationship with like Jennifer? Do you think that he was just with her to get back at Gail?
I think it's a lot more psychologically damaging than that. I think it's because she was Gail.
Yeah. It's like, if I can't have the real Gail, I'll take this actress who's pretending to be Gail.
Exactly.
Even though they're nothing alike, but it still has that like thought process.
Yeah.
Props to Parker Posey, though. I mean, she was the better looking Gail in this movie.
Her hair was much better.
Call back to the original Scream, those blonde highlights. Man, I forgot that was a trend.
Yeah.
And probably one of the greatest scenes involving a fax machine that I can think of.
I thought that was sick.
Yeah, me too. Except like Steven is like a fucking idiot. Like, you know, getting the faxes, the power's out. I like how they have like the script, like they're reading the script, like the actors, then they're like, he was like, we gotta get the fuck out of here. And then they grab the last one, like, the person that will survive is, and Steven's like, I just gotta fucking know.
The one who smells the gas.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah. But like that whole scene too, like, how does he know he's gonna light that lighter?
There's no way of knowing.
Yeah, I mean, the powers, he cut the power.
Yeah,
flashlight.
Flashlight.
Yeah.
I mean, this is before the age of smartphones, so people weren't just readily carrying around cell phones with flashlights. But I mean, come on, like flashlight. I don't think of lighting a lighter when the power goes out.
No. Unless I'm lighting a candle, but...
Unless I'm lighting a candle.
Back in like the late 90s, you're more likely to have a lighter on you than a flashlight.
He was a smoker, so I guess that's kind of working in his detriment there. Smoking kills.
So this plan just had to have worked out 100% perfectly for it to have worked.
Yeah, like what if Dewey had gone in there?
Yeah.
He doesn't smoke. What if Gail had gone in there? She doesn't smoke. Anybody else could have gone in there and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was relying on the fact that dude was a smoker and dude definitely wasn't the brightest crayon in the box. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. No. Like everybody else was telling him to stay out of the house. He's like, I gotta know. No, you don't. No, you don't, man.
Yeah.
And I like how, because it says the killer shows mercy too. So it's like, this guy's getting a quick death. He's not being tortured like the rest of the people, but it's like a play on words basically. Right. Like you think he's showing mercy, like, oh, I'm going to survive. Like, no, you're just going to have a quick death. Unlike everybody else.
Yeah.
I will have to say though, as sick as this kill scene was, it was out of place in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Not a Ghostface kill.
No.
And it's just like Ghostface kills are supposed to be elaborate, yet using simple methodologies here.
And up close and personal.
Up close and personal. Mm-hmm. Things like that. This was one of those things that could have gone terribly wrong very easily, ruined his whole plan. Again, like you said, it had to be executed 100% perfectly, which means that he is just an amazing director and can anticipate his actors' abilities and their thought processes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, fun kill scene to watch, but just way out of place in a Scream movie.
But it's also like he almost has like the J.J. Abrams effect inside this movie, right? Like the bigger the explosion, the better.
Well, I was thinking Michael Bay.
Michael Bay featuring explosions.
Yeah. That's what I meant to say, not J.J. Abrams, but yeah.
If there were lens flares, then yes, it would be J.J. Abrams.
And then they roll down the hill like for 5 minutes.
Oh my God.
Dewey even says like, why are we rolling so much?
How big is this hill?
Yeah.
It is. It's like, it's a parody in and of itself too. Cause like, even when, what the fuck was her name? Angelina, she comes out of like the trees, like way the fuck on the other side of the road. They're like, how did you get so far away?
Yeah.
It's just like a complete parody of, I don't know, I guess horror movies in a sense, which is what these movies tend to do, but.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I think about that or thought about that the last time I watched this movie. The whole parody aspect of it. So, you know, like we had the Scary Movie franchise and stuff like that, which borrowed very heavily, especially on the first one from Scream.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a horror movie that's laughing at itself and the genre? I think of Cabin in the Woods as another example of a movie that laughs at the absurdity of horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's what Scream 3 was trying to do?
Yeah, to an extent, maybe.
Yeah.
I think in a way, all of them really are.
Yeah. Because it's the whole meta thing, right? Like this movie's able to do it because it has like the movie within a movie kind of inception sort of thing, right? Like, so it's like you're on the inside and the outside looking in within the whole set and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
In Screamception. Got it.
Yeah. Inception.
Ooh. I like it.
And then Gail is about to be killed by Ghostface, and then Dewey saves the day, sort of, and is about to kiss Gail, and then Jennifer comes out and doesn't even get mad at the fact he's about to kiss her, but just like, you're supposed to be protecting me.
Where were you?
Where the fuck have you been?
I like how dramatic Jennifer is during like this whole movie. Mm-hmm. She's just like, do you see, I haven't had one of the, I forget how long it's been. Like, I haven't one of these in 2 years or 5 years or whatever. She's just holding the cigarette. She's barely smoking it. Like, have you ever actually smoked a cigarette before? Just like, she's so freaking dramatic during this movie. It's absolutely hilarious to watch.
But that's Parker Posey, right?
That is Parker Posey.
She's brilliant. A very dramatic actress. Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. You didn't mention it during the Parker Posey thing, and I just thought of it now. She was also in a movie called You've Got Mail with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan.
That's right.
She was dating Tom Hanks. I liked her in that movie because, again, she's just over the top. She's so self-involved and everything. Mm-hmm. Parker Posey pulls that off well. That was her moment to shine in Lost in Space TV show when she got to play Dr. Smith. you know, she's just so self-involved and all for her own preservation. And she does that well anytime she gets to play that role. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Take it back.
It's all good.
Stop apologizing.
I'm sorry for being sorry, damn it.
Stop it now.
One thing in this movie that I don't really care too much for is that they got Randy and his sister in this. It's like... Can we just like pick one or the other? Like, don't have both of them in.
It definitely was, in my opinion, a cop out. You know, they found a way to get Jamie Kennedy involved. Again, trying to just shove the nostalgia in our face a little bit. They were just keeping that trend going, explaining, you know, like the first one, here's how you survive a horror movie. Second one, here's how you survive a sequel. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about something completely different, a trilogy and things. It's just, I get where they were going from. And would he have really sat there and thought, I bet you if I die, they're going to try to make the killer is going to make this a trilogy. Let me record this real quick.
And like, if he did by any chance make this video, he would have made it easy to find so that like people know that it's there. So he's helping them from beyond the grave. But his sister just found it like 4 years after his death, 2 years, 3 years, however long after his death.
It would have been sitting like in his dorm room since he died at college. It would have been sitting in his dorm room with a note on it said, give to Sydney, give to, or like to Dewey or something like that. It wouldn't have just been packed away and forgotten about.
Yeah.
Nah. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
And then the random Carrie Fisher cameo, whatever. She kind of like talked about how like she wasn't cast as Princess Leia. It's like, it's so funny.
Who gets the role? The one who sleeps with George Lucas.
Yeah.
I like to whenever she's Gail's trying to bribe her. She's like, would you like, do you know the president or something like that? Or would you work for the president? And she flashes her a 50 and she was the president of blah, 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 whatever the company is.
The studio.
Yeah, the studio. And then Parker Posey's like $50. What are you like working with a high school student? Which is ironic.
Yes. Because... Scream 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher. I have to say that was one... Especially now that she's no longer with us. I mean, I enjoyed that cameo before her passing, but now watching it, it just gives me the warm and tinglies all over. I love Carrie Fisher. Mm-hmm. She's just so much fun to watch.
And Fred had mentioned that whenever Dewey shot Ghostface, he dropped another picture that he had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is really kind of starting. They think that they're putting like the picture together. They think it's John Milton because he produced all three Stab films and he knew Maureen. And I really like this scene with Sid at her like old house on the set. When she's like running away from Ghostface and then like she like runs out the door and like grabs on, he like falls out of the door onto the bed, and then she's like going nuts, you know, screaming for Dewey to help her. And then he's get that like first like kind of blanket with the blood on it, and like you hear Maureen's voice and get sick.
That scene was terrifying too.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sitting here ragging on the whole nostalgia thing because again, they just kept shoving it in our face throughout this movie. But I really did like that where she's sitting there walking around her bedroom, but it's not her bedroom, and you're hearing the you're hearing the dialogue from the first movie between her and Billy and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And she even says it right there out loud. It's like, would you settle for a PG-13 or whatever she said? And just like, again, just psychologically messing with her. Like, even after this, how do you continue to like to live a quote unquote normal life after this? I mean, that's just really messing with your brain.
So
Dewey and Gail and Jennifer, I think, go to Milton's kind of studio office, and they kind of confront him like, oh, like you're the one that killed Maureen and is doing all this. And you know, then they find out it's Roman's birthday, and they're not sure what does he say to make them kind of go away and go like against his story of why he killed them.
Why am I drawing a blank on this all of a sudden?
I can't think of what happened in that scene.
He's like, he finally admits like, yes, I knew Maureen. I didn't realize it was her until I had already signed on to do the picture or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
God. I'm at the scene where Sydney's at the set now. And I think what the John Milton scene happens right after this.
Yeah. Pretty close to it, I think. Cause I think, Sid goes back to Kincaid, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dewey and them invite her to the party, and she's coming with Kincaid to Roman's party.
Yeah.
Because Milton does say, like, I didn't bring it up or anything like that, or I didn't acknowledge that I knew because I would be a suspect.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just trying to look through notes here.
I just wish I could remember. I'm just drawing a blank on it.
Yeah.
He felt she couldn't play by the rules, and that's why she didn't last in Hollywood. Anyways,
very Harvey Weinstein of him.
Well, and Angelina even makes reference to how he is basically a Harvey Weinstein. She was like, I didn't sleep with that piece of shit Milton for to be replaced by a B movie actress.
I absolutely love this kind of like end scene at Roman's house. I think like the whole set of his house is really sick. And the way they have like everyone at the party there with him.
Did you recognize that house?
Not
it's in another
really?
Famous horror franchise installment.
Really?
Halloween H2O. That is the place where the school was.
Oh shit.
Yep.
It's been a minute since I've watched that movie.
I think it's a good one.
I mean, it's better than Resurrection.
Truth. But yeah, that was a cool house, and it's there are a lot of great sequences in that scene, and all the scenes happening at that house.
Yeah,
they got like it down in the basement. You know, Roman goes down there with I think Jennifer, and he has like all like the costumes and stuff from his days, I guess, as producer director. And then they ended up finding him like in the freezer, you know, with the knife and his bleeding, and Gail does the terrible check your heartbeat, because I guess unless he took some sort of like pill or something, you know, to slow his heartbeat.
Yeah,
there's what's the name of that movie? Behind the Mask. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Where
Leslie Vernon.
Yes. Yeah. And he actually talks about the whole being able to slow down your heart rate thing and stuff like that and make it like seem like you're dead.
Yeah.
And so I truly believe it's kind of a scary thought, but I truly believe that there are people out there who could possibly slow their heart rate down and pretend to be dead. And that's just an absolutely terrifying thought in my mind.
Yeah,
it'd just be like a meditative state, right? Because that's basically what meditation is slowing your heart rate, slowing your breathing. Like it would just be like an extreme case of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, people are panicked too. So, I mean, I'm so sorry, Brooke.
No, go ahead.
People are panicked. So, like, when you're in panic mode, you're not really thinking logically, you know. So, you're checking for a pulse or something like that. You might maybe feel a little something, but your panic mode will probably be like, you don't feel anything, or you misread it, or you misinterpret it and stuff like that. So, it could very well, she could have still felt something, but because she's scared out of her, you know, mind, nope, she didn't feel a damn thing.
Plus, he's in a freezer too, right? So he's cold. So his heart rate's automatically going to be lower than what it normally would be.
That's true too. Yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Fair point.
And then Gale and Dewey find the costume and the voice changer. I don't know if you guys remember, but like from your first or second watch, at this point, did you think that it was anyone else within the cast that could have been the killer?
Well, they kind of played off that it could be Angelina helping out at one point. Cause like they see her, she has the props and the phones and the costume. And she's like, she's like, well, I just wanted souvenirs from the set. I figured I'd be okay to take them if they're not going to make the movie anymore, kind of thing. So like they kind of play it off that like that's sort of a possibility, but
yeah,
that'd be my only, and like the cop, maybe like McDreamy.
And that was a again another example of subverting the expectation there, because leading up to this point, the first two installments of this film, there were two killers, two people working together. This one, they wanted you to believe that there was a second one. And you needed to figure out who the two were. It just never would have dawned on anybody that it was just one person pulling it off. And if anybody actually, again, looking back at the evidence, if anybody actually could have been the second killer, the cop, Kincaid, is definitely a prime suspect. He knows way too much, and he can he reads these scenes perfectly and stuff like that. It's almost like he's giving it away, like, hey, I know something. But it was kind of disappointing that he was innocent. So,
yeah, because like the first picture, I think he brings to Gale, right? And she's not even like a part of anything. Mm-hmm. And then Dewey shows up and she's like, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, Kincaid told me everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of odd. You're like, why is Kincaid spilling the beans about everything as a detective? You know, he should be playing things close to the chest, but.
Especially with the reporter.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, he even does say, like, hey, if you tell anyone, like, your Pulitzer Prize or whatever is going to get taken away or whatever it was. The scene, whenever they're in the bedroom, I feel like they could have taken Ghostface because there was, like, what, like, three of them in there with them? Tyson ends up getting stabbed and then kind of chased down the hallway, tossed off the balcony like Sarah Michelle Gellar in the second movie. He doesn't make it. Jennifer gets killed, kind of just like stabbed, you know, nothing too special.
I'm the killer.
I did like this scene that had like the secret like hallway that Jennifer found. And then she like ends up running down to it, and like the mirrors are there, and then Dewey and Gale on the other side, and they like Dewey's like, you hear something? And then he starts shooting the mirrors. If I did get this scene either a bit, because like he shoots like all of the mirrors from like the left to like the end, and then shoots the one with her, and she falls through, but then Ghostface is gone. It's like,
yeah,
where did he go?
Yeah,
it makes zero sense at all, but hey.
But maybe he knows about a second hidden hallway.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's true. Yeah. One of the best scenes and most hilarious scenes is whenever he throws the knife at Dewey's.
Oh my head. God, man. Like, yeah. What the fuck? Dewey could have easily dodged that.
Yeah.
And like for it to knock him out, like that's a hard throw.
Yeah, to knock him down the stairs, it's like, dude, okay, come on.
Poor Dewey.
He's always getting fucking his ass kicked in these movies.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the first movie he didn't get stabbed in, though.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess without giving too much away about what you think of the motive, what did you think you guys think of like the final scene with the reveal of Ghostface and all that?
I talk about it later. I like the motive, but I don't like, how did I word it later on? Let me see here. I don't remember where I put it. His motive is like good and it's understandable, mm-hmm. but I don't like that it's in the movie.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't like that story, that storyline of him being like Maureen's bastard son and like she abandoned him and yeah. like it's Sydney's half brother or stepbrother, mm-hmm. however you want to, like, whatever you want to consider it. I don't like that. But with it all being said, like, his motive and his driving force for doing this makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that were to actually happen, I just don't like the fact that it's written into the movie.
I agree 100%. And I'm going to take it one step further. It even continued to nosedive when part of that motive and part of the entire story involved going all the way back to the original Scream about how he is the one who kind mm-hmm. of nudged Billy Loomis mm-hmm. into the mm-hmm. direction, and how he was the one who kind of made like Cotton, like frame Cotton weary and stuff like that. Like, he is the ultimate Matt. It started to just get a little ridiculous after the story just keeps going and going. He keeps talking and talking. I'm just like, this is beginning to just be a little bit more unbelievable. And yeah, it's an interesting story and an interesting motive. Could have done without it.
But at the same time, it fits Randy's trilogy rules to a T. Because yeah, one of the rules that he had stated in the video was forget everything that you know about the first two movies, because it's all about to change in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what happens. But I don't like that they take the credit away from Billy, because that twist at the end of Scream was so iconic and so like mind-blowing at the time, and now they've kind of stripped Billy of that.
But they gave Billy back that power in Scream 5, and I'm very appreciative.
Yeah,
I agree with you guys both. And also I thought it was weird that like nobody in the town of Woodsboro even like knew about Sydney's brother or Maureen's like bastard son. Cause like Gail wrote like a whole book on like the Woodsboro murders and like knew everything about Maureen Prescott. So like, how did none of that ever get brought up? But
mm-hmm.
I guess they had to save it for the third movie.
And yeah, like for an investigative journalist, she just really did not do her job very well. I mean, why don't you dig more into the past of Maureen? So why Maureen Prescott? Was it just because she was having an affair? No, there's got to be something deeper than that. So you got to start digging into the past, and she probably mm-hmm. would have discovered her past life.
Well, yeah. And she did dig into her past, because her and Dewey are talking at the start of the movie, and Dewey says she's lived in Woodsboro her entire life, and Gail says almost her entire life. There was a 2-year period where she just like went completely off the map and nobody knew where she was. So I mean, it's understandable that nobody knew that story, like that part of her story, her life story. But I mean, if you're figuring it all out now, you could have easily figured it out 3-4 years ago whenever you were writing your book. But
yeah.
I love this final fight between Sid and Roman. I thought it was badass. Like,
it was.
Sid was holding her own. She was getting some good punches in there. She was taking some hits. I thought it was fucking sick.
I liked Roman as Ghostface. I thought he was I don't like some of the kills, like with the explosion and how like the originality was kind of gone, but like he had no problem like getting into fist fights with people and like he didn't specifically use his weapons like all the time. Like he used his hands as his weapons mm-hmm. often, more often than what any of the other ghost faces had previously. Like he's beating the shit out of Sydney with his fists, and then he's trying to kill her by choking her, which is not something that we've seen in any of the previous movies.
Yeah.
Like it was a lot more up close. He has the
bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
That no one ever really had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so does she.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like brother, like sister.
And like realistically, he could have killed her. Mm-hmm. If Dewey and Gale weren't there.
True.
Yeah.
Like he would have had her, I think.
I will say that I don't mind Roman as Ghostface at all. I don't mind that he's the killer. In fact, he does crazy very well. Mm-hmm. Does crazy very well. Not as well as Billy, but no. he does do it, and it's just like, wow, this guy is definitely off the rails, and it's fun mm-hmm. to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, oh, Kincaid's at the house as well the whole time too.
Yeah.
I think he ends up getting stabbed or shot, but he ends up surviving, I think. And I like the final scene, like whenever she finally kills Roman, and then the classic, the killer's not dead, and Roman stands up, is like rotted, and fucking Dewey's unloading like two guns into him.
Yeah.
And then finally, the head, and he just like shoots him in the head.
Dewey's a bad cop, man. Like
awful.
He's a terrible cop.
He is, yes.
And like then he goes back to Woodsboro and they make him sheriff. Come on, guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not good.
Not good.
Now it cuts to the end of the movie. I'm not sure how far past it is, but anyway, so now Dewey is proposing to Gale. Seems kind of forced, to be honest, in my mind. But they're together, and he proposes. Kincaid's alive, and
dating Sydney.
Yeah, and
like where did that come from?
Sydney, like,
I hate that.
You know, open the gate, and you know everything's open now. And she closes the door, and then the door like opens, and she just kind of looks at it and leaves the door open. It's like, okay, sure.
I don't like that Kincaid and Sydney are together.
No, it's like, talk about forced. I mean, mm-hmm. come on. Like, there was no like sexual chemistry between the two in the entire mm-hmm. movie. And then all of a sudden, oh, they're together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I guess it's implied that he's the father of her children in Scream 5. Do they outright say it, or is it just implied?
I don't remember either.
Now I got to rewatch it.
And is he in Scream 4? I don't remember that either.
No, they don't even make any mention of him or anything like that in Scream 4.
Yeah,
she has no kids, nothing like that. I'm trying to remember because I just watched Scream 4 the other day, and I'm trying to remember if she even had a wedding ring on or anything, and mm-hmm. I don't remember that either. Mm. So
I don't know.
We'll pay attention. We'll
find
to
out
it.
Next week.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, we'll pay attention to it next week.
But yeah, I think that pretty much covers it. Anything else that you guys wanted to talk about or mention before we wrap up the discussion?
I think I'm good.
I'm good.
Cool. That's the way the blood splatters.
They used to be few and far between.
I know, I got distracted. There's more than two people here, so yeah.
I'm going to have to get Erica back on. She'll cover it for us.
Okay, I see how it is.
All right, it's time for us to review or rate this movie. Chuck is our guest. We'll let you go first, starting off with your story out of 10.
I give it a 5. I want to love this story. I really do. But you know, as soon as it was revealed that you're like Roman Sydney's brother, and then the whole thing, how he pushed Billy into doing things, framing Cotton Weary, how he basically wants to take responsibility for everything that has happened up to this point. I'm just like, why? I just felt like it just took a nosedive. I am going to sit there and say that it's only fitting that, you know, the killer be connected to Sydney in some intimate way. You know, Scream 1, 1 and 2, the killers minus Mickey were connected to Sydney in one way or another, you know, Billy mm-hmm. being the jealous boyfriend and of course the victim of, you know, his father having an affair with Sydney's mother, you know, Stu being a friend of Sydney, and then of course Billy's mother in Scream 2. So mm-hmm. Mickey again just being kind of the you know, outlier there. It's fitting that the killer in Scream 3 be connected to Sydney in some way, shape, or form, and even carrying over into the fourth one, which we'll talk about next week. Mm-hmm. But the brother thing just kind of, to me, it felt weak. It kind of felt forced. And as, again, especially since they tried to just keep tying it back to the previous installments of the film, like he's the ultimate mastermind behind everything. And it's just like, it took what could have been a great story and made it a mediocre story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about your quality?
I'll give it a 7.
Okay.
So despite the story, I thought the film itself was good. Some of it felt rushed and some of it again felt forced. You know, the Detective Kincaid's character, you know, kind of the throwaway there where I thought it was going to be the second killer, or at least involved some way, shape, or form. But also thinking back on Kincaid, he felt like an afterthought. Like his character just shows up sporadically mm-hmm. throughout the film. And like, just like, hey, we need something else in this film. Patrick Dempsey's available. All right, let's see if you can film for a couple of days. The kills were pretty standard in comparison to the first two films, except for that gas scene. That was the outlier, definitely, in that one. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, the thing that gives us a lower quality rating is just the nostalgia, just trying to hit us with that nostalgia to death. Everything was about Scream 1. Everything was about Scream 1. Everything was about Scream 1. You don't need to nostalgize us to death. We've made it this far into the franchise. We're obviously committed. We want to know what's going on. Give us something new. Give us something fresh. Give us something original. It's, you know, kind of like the same thing I said about Star Wars Episode 7. You don't need to remind us why we're here. We're here. Just give us the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
But overall, 7.
Cool.
Very nice.
What about you, Brooke?
So for my story, I gave it a 6 out of 10. I said making a horror trilogy is hard, especially trying to keep the story going and making sense. Yeah. Somehow the writers managed to intertwine each of the past movies with the story, even if it's out of their ass. I didn't enjoy the side characters that much, but our main three characters really carried this movie, I thought. Because even the second one, we kind of were hating on the main three characters a little bit, I think, eh, Mark?
A little bit.
I felt they were a lot better in this movie. Mm-hmm. The first half was kind of slow for me, but I really liked the second half.
Mm-hmm.
And then for quality, I give it a 7 out of 10. The acting is not great in this one, but our main three are pretty good. I absolutely love the set in this movie, and the score is decent as well.
Nice.
So 6 out of 10 and 7 out of 10.
All right. I kind of chuckled when you gave your scores. My story, I gave it a 6 out of 10. Nice. I said I got over the whole stab thing after Scream 2. I get the point behind it because Hollywood likes to make a buck off of franchises and sequels, bringing the fans, and the Scream franchise is meta as fuck. So it's like kind of making fun of that whole process. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold, so I'm coughing a lot.
All good.
I would have liked to see them stray from that storyline in this one. But I mean, we do see that in Scream 4, which is good. It's still an enjoyable movie, obviously, but it's my least favorite Scream movie. I also think the long lost half brother thing is kind of stupid. His motives do make a lot of sense, but I just think that whole story arc is poor writing. You can tell this isn't a Kevin Williamson film.
Yes. Yes.
And just like Brooke, my quality is also a 7.
Oh, geez.
Nice.
I said it's still a, well, actually, Chuck, you gave a 17.
I know.
Yeah, all three of us for quality. It's still a Scream movie, and it has most of the things that we love about the franchise. The acting was a bit cheesy outside of the typical good performances of our main three. I'm glad Dewey lost his ridiculous run and dead arm from Scream 2.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You can still see the limp, but, I mean, he doesn't look like he sorry, has cerebral palsy or something like that.
Oh my.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No. Stop apologizing.
The kills were good, and Roman was a very good ghost face. I know I shit on the whole like Return to Woodsboro thing, but I did like the nostalgia of seeing the original set. And Chuck, you kind of shit on that part, but I liked that whole scene with Sydney in her bedroom and like the flashback, the auditory flashbacks and stuff like that.
Again, it was nice. I appreciated that scene. Mm-hmm. It's just like, but aside from that, it was just nothing but nostalgia, reminding us that it's connected to the previous two installments. Yeah. And like, we get it. We do. We really do.
I liked that they really intertwined. This could go in my story section, but I liked that they intertwined her mental health state in regards to like Maureen's death and like everything that she's gone through. It just made her feel like so much more of a raw character, that she does have weakness, that she is human, and that she is actually affected by all the events that have happened in her life. It's not just like a, like in Scream 1, like she was obviously upset about her mother's death and whatnot, but like it didn't show the actual like traumatic effect that it has on her. So I liked that they included that in this one. Story 6 out of 10, quality 7 out of 10 for me.
Nice.
So we're all like pretty synced
pretty
up.
Pretty even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, for me, like this movie and Scream 2 like kind of interchange of which one I like more, honestly.
Okay.
That's fair.
On this watch, like would you put this one ahead of Scream 2 or would you put Scream 2 ahead of it?
I think I put Scream 2 ahead of it. But okay. My last watch I did last year, I put this one ahead of Scream 2. So
I remember that.
I don't know.
I remember that because I was like, oh, that's a hot take, but okay. Yeah. All right, you guys know our scores. Let's head on over to Rotten Tomatoes and see what they've scored it. The critics' consensus, despite some surprising twists, Scream 3 sees the franchise falling back on the same old horror formulas and cliches it once hacked and slashed with postmodern abandon.
Yeah, but see, that's why we love this franchise.
Well, exactly. Like, that's what they've all done.
Yeah.
Chuck, this is going to you. What do you think the critics scored it based off of that consensus? Just the percentage number.
I am going to say 62.
41.
Aha! Damn.
Wow.
Okay. I was going to be nicer than they were, apparently. Yeah.
41% on 126 reviews and an average score of 5.2 out of 10.
Crazy.
The audience, 31%.
Wow. Okay.
Or sorry, 37%. 37%.
Well, that's not much better.
Not much better. But, 250,000 ratings and an average score of 3 out of 5 or a 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible. It's probably the lowest rated in the entire franchise, I would gather.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, see, Letterboxd is always super close to the audience consensus. So Letterboxd is 2.9 out of 5. Mark and myself gave it a 3.5. Anthony from Porcelain Peak gave it a 3.5. Our friend Josh from HMC gave it a 4.5.
Of course he did.
I mean,
love you, Josh.
And Jensen gave it a 3 out of 5 from the Fright Crew.
Nice. Chuck, if you had to give it a rating out of 5, what would you give it?
I would give it a 3.
3?
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense.
I mean, this is my least favorite of the 5 films. Mm-hmm. And with that being said, I still enjoy watching this film. So if it's my least favorite, that's great. Yeah, 3 would definitely be my rating.
Yeah. I think Josh is just like, I just have to shit a 4.5. I don't know. I feel like, yeah, because he loves the franchise so much that it's just like a disservice to the franchise if he gives it anything less than like a 4.
That's the thing about loving a franchise. You can recognize when there are installments to it that are less than stellar. I mean, not every Halloween movie was worth the installment or the watch. Not every Nightmare on Elm Street, not every Friday the 13th. They're not all going to be worth the installment. But you can still love the franchise. Saw. There's like a few films in the Saw franchise that I can't even freaking stand, but I still love the franchise. So, I mean, it's okay to give something a low rating. You were just watching Indiana Jones and, you know, Temple of Doom. Great film, great franchise. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I'd like to pretend, doesn't even exist.
I think everyone does, yeah.
But, you know, I'm not going to shit on the franchise. I don't think it's shitting on the franchise by saying, hey, that installment wasn't even worth it, and I'm a little concerned about the next installment coming out. So, you know, I think it's okay. Josh, like you said, he's a diehard Scream fan. Love the guy to death. He does understand, like, he's got his feelings about this, and he's entitled to them. He's just not right.
All right, you guys ready for the scare section?
Let's do it.
Yes, sir.
All right. Brooke.
Yes.
How about you go first? What did you give for a scare rating?
Sure. So I gave the scare rating a 3 out of 10. None of the kills are really like gruesome or bloody out of the ordinary, but I did think the intensity was dialed up a little bit in a couple of the scenes. Like with the kind of like maze house they have at the end, you know, when Jennifer's in the mirror room, and I thought it was pretty intense, but nothing too crazy. So 3 out of 10. And then scariest scene, just to continue on with that, I said the scene in Roman's house whenever Jennifer is in like the mirrored room and she's banging, trying to figure it out. And yeah, I just love that whole scene in Roman's house.
Nice.
And then Order to Survive, I said yes, because I'm not good enough an actor to be cast in Stab 3.
You probably could have been better than some of them.
Yeah.
Or maybe, yeah. Chuck might finally be an extra in a movie when they come film in his town.
There you go.
Unfortunately, they're not filming any more Scream movies in my town that I know of anyway.
Stupid.
I know.
Which
trust me, I keep the cat, like I subscribe to the casting calls, and so like nice. Nothing exciting has been coming up lately. Yeah. I'm disappointed.
There's been a bunch of, because I'm on an email list too for ones up here, and it seems like every time that they're filming or like needing someone that like I would fit the profile, I'm working or like I'm gone away or I'm doing same. Something. I'm like, God damn it. Like film on a same. Weekend.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, or, you know, they require 1,000 COVID tests on the days that I'm working. Like I'd be available to film, but then they need you to be available for COVID tests on the days you're not. I'm just like, for crying out loud.
Yeah. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah. Me too. You don't even have to pay me. I just want to be on screen. Damn it.
Yeah. I have a buddy that, was it season 2 or season 3 of, Titans whenever,
ooh, good show.
Whenever Robin is in the prison,
mm-hmm.
one of my buddies is in the background. He's one of the prisoners working out. Yeah.
That's fun.
Cause they filmed it up here at, Kingston Penn for one of the days.
Nice.
But yeah, anyways, Chuck, what did you give the movie for a scare rating?
Surprisingly, I gave it a 5 out of 10. Okay. To me, this had the least amount of scare factor overall. It was more like, let's bog it down with some funny scares / jump scares.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, again, and this will go along with my scariest scene. Like the one that really got me was, you know, Sid's dream about her mom while she's at the house, you know, the window, you know, like, let me in, Sydney. Whore, just like your mother. I'll be happy to give this an 8 out of 10 if we're going to include Courtney Cox's bangs. So
that's the scariest scene.
Yeah. And then would I survive? I said yes, because I'm confident I could kick Roman's ass.
Okay.
All right.
guy's a tool.
Well, I mean, you're Chuck Norris, so I assume you could kick his ass, right?
I'm going to the gym 5 days a week. I'm working on that roundhouse. I'll kick his ass.
He had a nice leg sweep, though.
He did.
He did. Yeah. For my scare rating, I also gave it a 3 out of 10. I said there were the same typical scares of the previous ones, but like with less jump scares. Jump scares. Oh my God. My voice caught in my throat for a second. We had less of like Ghostface just jumping out of nowhere in this one. Mm-hmm. The kills weren't as gory or creative as the first two installments, but the scenes with Maureen, like you said, Chuck, were effectively creepy. My scariest scene, I originally said Sydney's nightmare sequences, but Chuck, you said that one as well. But also the scene with like the bloody sheet ghost thing coming at Sydney. I thought that was effectively. Yeah. Done effectively. Would I survive? I said, I don't know. I said Roman was a tough motherfucker. And I feel like but like at the same time, like if I'm in this position, like if I'm in Sydney's position, like I'd be at a bit of an advantage because the set was an exact replica of my hometown. So like her house was kind of the exact same, although she did almost fall out of that one doorway that mm-hmm. kind of dropped down onto a different set. But yeah, I don't know. I thought like Roman is one of like the toughest ghost face killers.
I'll agree with that.
So I think he'd be a tough fight.
Kind of brutal with Sydney.
Yeah. And he does this all on his own, right? Like he doesn't need that secondary person. So it just further adds to the way that he goes about things, I guess. The things that he's able to do while he's on his own. So I don't know, it'd be a tough fight. But anyways.
I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him. And then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
That leads us to the last part of the episode where we are going to do Loomis's villain evaluation. I've kind of talked in depth of what this is on every episode up to now, but I'll do it again. So much like we did with Scream and Scream 2, we are going to be rating the killer in this movie, well, the ghost face in this movie, in terms of brutality, creativity, dexterity or agility, intelligence, drive, motive, and charisma. Each score is going to be out of 30. At the end of it, I'm going to add them all up and average them out. And then next week, we're going to conclude this set of the face-offs and see who would come out victorious.
Ooh, very good.
All right. Chuck, would you like one of us to go first, considering this is your first time doing one of these?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. I shall go first then.
Okay, fine.
It's just so Mark can add them up at the end. It makes it way quicker. So brutality, I gave a 16 out of 30. Okay. I said it's pretty much the same kills as the last movie. Stabs and back, thrown off balconies. You know, the explosion was the one kind of outlier, which we've talked about. So nothing too crazy. Creativity, I gave a 15 out of 30. Like I said, nothing too special with the kills. I really like the way that Roman's house was kind of like a maze and had secret hallways.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
wait. Wasn't it John Milton's house?
Yeah, that's Milton's
house. Oh, was it Milton's house?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Milton's house, and he was just hosting Roman's birthday there.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And we didn't even mention that Milton got his fucking throat slashed at the end either.
Yeah, true.
Nah.
Too late for that now.
Yeah. All right.
Bye, Bishop.
Intelligence, I gave a 23 out of 30. Roman came up with his plan since day one. He even passed it on to Billy. The way he uses the up-to-date voice changer is great because he doesn't need like any help making calls, and we kind of talked about that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Agility, I forgot about that stat, honestly, but I gave it a 25 out of 30. Roman, like Mark said, is like one of the toughest ghost faces we've seen. He moves around the house really well, and yeah, he just is a good ghost face. Motive, I gave a 22 out of 30. I said Roman has a pretty good motive, the kind of dump to side bastard brother. He wanted to create his own movie, quite literally too, like he was making a movie and then made his own side movie. But also, like how I brought up before, how does nobody from Woodsboro not know about him for like two movies, including Gale, which we did talk about. So, and then charisma, I give a 14 out of 30. He wasn't the most charismatic guy. Like even like as a producer, you didn't see much of him. It was just like him on the phone talking to people throughout the movie mostly. And then like at the very end with Sydney, he was pretty charismatic, but I didn't think he stood out that much for me. So 14 out of 30.
Nice. All right. I'll go ahead and do mine, and then I can add up all three of them while Chuck's going through his too. That's cool.
Lay it on us.
All right. My brutality, I gave a 20. I said he was tough as nails and fought with his hands a lot more, so it takes away from the gore factor that normally comes with this score, but it also adds to the fact that, like, he was just like a good fighter. But he also, like, he lacked the psychoticism that the past Ghostface characters had. Like, he's not stabbing himself to, like, make him, like, to give himself the alibi and all that shit. With that being said, I'm also grouping his psychological warfare in here because the way that he abused Sydney's mental state was like just fucking brutal in its own way. Yeah. So he used that more to his advantage than anyone else has done.
That's a good point, honestly.
Yeah. Like it's not like physical brutality, but just a real fucking piece of shit.
Mental abuse is very brutal in its own right. Mm-hmm. And he definitely nailed it on this movie.
Yeah. Creativity, I gave him a 22. I said he's a movie director, so he obviously has like some high creativity. I have already mentioned it, but I love that he used Maureen so much in the movie to fuck with Sydney. He also had the vocal changer that can make him sound like any person in the movie. He's also the only ghost face that didn't have any help from a secondary person. So he planned and performed all of this by himself. But one thing that like really took away from this stat for me is that the kills were often reused. So I don't know if I can take that away from him or if it's just, obviously it's the way that the movie was written, but he loses like the kill creativity for me.
Mm-hmm.
Cause just like rinse and repeat of everything else that's already happened sort of thing. Dexterity, I gave him a 27. I said this is the first ghost face that isn't a complete klutz. Like we rarely saw him slipping or tripping or falling or anything like that. He was good on his feet, very fast. He used his own hands a lot in the fights and didn't rely on his weapons for every attack. And he also was the closest one to almost killing Sydney out of any of the ghost face characters so far.
Yeah, that's true.
So his fight was a very high factor. Intelligence, I gave him a 24. I said he used his director gadgets to help plan things out and knew exactly how to get certain people to where he wanted them to go. He's also been hiding in the dark, in quotations, for all of Sydney's life and waiting for the right time to strike. I don't necessarily like this plot twist, but you can't ignore the fact that he got Stu and Billy to do all of his dirty work in the first movie. So his planning is basically impeccable for the past, like, let's just say 5 years.
Yeah.
He's really been like doing it for this long. His drive and motive, I gave a 26. I said, realistically, his driving force is the same as Billy's. His mom abandoned him and he was getting back at the people that were the reason for her doing so. And charisma, I gave him a 12. I said, he's a whiny little bitch and I couldn't stand him. And it seemed like most people in the movie couldn't either. Most of the crew forgot about his birthday and no one seemed to really have a relationship with him outside of him being their director. So.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
All right, are you ready, Chuck, for me to skew all of this?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. All right. So for brutality, I'm going to give him a 20 out of 30. Again, the psychological warfare that he waged on Sydney, absolutely brutal. He's definitely one of the more hands-on killers, literally putting his hands all over Sydney, punches, throat choking, all that fun stuff. I kind of want to rethink my answer, would I survive this film? I really did not take all that into account. I still think I had a fighting chance. Creativity, I was torn on this one. I gave him a 17 originally, but after listening to you two, I really began to think about it. So, you know, creativity, y'all talked about how, you know, he didn't really do anything original with his kills, except for maybe the gas scene and stuff like that. Some of it was kind of reused, but many would say that as a director in Hollywood, he inspired the people that he motivated, Billy and Stu, which in turn motivated Billy's mom and Mickey. Through his spurring and through his direction, he inspired creativity in others. And so paying the ultimate homage to the people that he inspired, yes, he may have reused or modified some of the kills that came before him. So I got to give him points for that, because that's probably the most Hollywood thing, is for directors to reuse other people's ideas or things. Musicians do it all the time. They reuse bits and pieces of their music in their compositions and stuff like that, and nobody bats an eye.
It's true.
So I originally said 17. I'm going to upgrade that to a 20.
Okay.
I really think he may not be creative on his own, but he inspires creativity just like a director should. Dexterity, agility, I gave him a 25. I mean, this man is all over the place. He's a one-man show, and he makes you believe that he's got somebody helping him. And since he turns out to be a one-man show, I don't know how he does what he does and gets away with it. Intelligence, I gave him a 22 out of 30. Again, he's had to orchestrate this whole thing. So from the very beginning, and execute every part of the plan perfectly, and, you know, have backup plans and everything else like that. He is pretty smart. The only thing he does, and what every killer does, is they underestimate Sydney's will to live.
Yeah.
Drive, motive. Again, I'm just so bothered by the whole idea about him being the brother and everything like that, that I kind of want to skew the score, but I'm going to go ahead and give him a 20. He feels scorned. He feels left behind. He feels outcast. And he wants to show the world that he's more than just the bastard of a forgotten about, you know, studio actress who slept around. You know, he wants to be recognized for what he is, and that is a true mastermind of real life horror as a director. So I'll give him that. And then finally for charisma, I'm going to give him a 20 on this one.
Okay.
Guys, no, he's not apparently charismatic. You said it. Everyone forgot his birthday. He mm-hmm. seems to have only okay relationships with the people that he works with. That's all purposeful. While he wants to be the center of attention, he can't be the center of attention. Otherwise, that draws too much attention to him. He's got to be the background character until the absolute right moment. So his lack of charisma is all an act. The charisma came at the end of the movie, and you can see the charisma that he has as a person when he finally gets to be himself, when he finally gets to step into that limelight. So I think he's full of it, full of charisma. And if we had gotten a chance to see it fully throughout the entire movie, the score would definitely be higher for me.
All right.
That's fair.
Yeah. I like it.
Never really thought about that with the charisma. He's still a whiny little bitch though.
Yes. A tool.
All right. So our scores averaged out will go as follows. For brutality, we combined with an 18.7. Creativity, a 19. Dexterity or agility, a 25.7. intelligence, a 23. Drive motive, a 22.7. And charisma, a 15.3.
Hmm. All right.
These are tough scores to beat.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
For Scream 4. And like, I thought this was going to be a blowout. So I don't know. No.
Can't wait to talk about Scream 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should be interesting. Yeah.
It's going to be very interesting. Because like when you sit down and you think about it, like, or I guess before you sit down and you think about it, like, just because this might be our least favorite movie in the franchise, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be the worst ghost face in the franchise.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be an interesting conversation next week.
Can't wait.
Forward to it.
Me too. All right. Do you guys have anything else just before we wrap it all up, or we good to call it a night?
I'm good.
You're good. All right, Chuck, do you want to plug your podcast one last time before we sign off?
Yes. My name is Jeffrey Chuck Norris, and I'm joined by my brother, Robert Ruff. Every 2 weeks, we talk about a different movie, movies that inspire us, make us want to watch other movies, or just, hell, make us just want to talk about movies. We're available on all the major podcast platforms, and you can find our social medias at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So go look us up, check us out, download us. I'm sure you're going to have a great time.
Yeah. Very good.
Very nice.
And we've all linked up in the past before too. You've been on our show. We've been on your show. We went on for Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh yes, I loved that discussion.
We also went on for
The Departed.
Sandlot.
The Sandlot, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And
y'all will be coming up soon.
Yeah, we have a big one coming up in November, I think.
Yes.
And you came on for our Evil Dead 2 and the Evil Dead remake comparison. Yeah. You came on for Dead Silence.
Love that movie.
What else have you been on with us? There's been a few.
I feel like there's one more.
Yeah, there was definitely one more. I feel like
there's one more. I'm drawing a blank now.
Me too.
I want to say, oh, crap. It wasn't Hell House.
No. There was definitely a third one, though.
Dead Silence. Evil Dead.
Hmm.
Boys, I'm drawing a blank. I honestly am.
It's going to bother me. It's going to bother me.
I'm about to say, don't take it personally, because I don't even remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I'm drawing a blank.
I'm going to find it, because it's going to bother me until I do.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we did the Lord of the Rings with you.
Yeah, we did that. We did Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd.
Oh, my
for
God.
March musicals.
And that was the most recent one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, Sweeney Todd.
Oh yeah, that Lord of the Rings roundtable episode, that was incredible too.
That was so much fun. I actually re-listened to that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
I love that episode. Turned out so well.
Yeah, it did. But anyways, as for us, if you guys want to catch us on social media, you can find us at a podcast on Elm Street on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. If you click the link in our bio on Instagram, you'll find links to our TeePublic account where we have our merch. There's also a Patreon account if you wish to support the podcast that way. There's also links to each of our individual Letterboxd accounts. Chuck, you got to get on that, man. Like,
I have a Letterboxd and I just keep forgetting about it.
You being the movie guy that you are, dude, like, there is so much stuff on there that you just need to be on there.
Yeah,
I know.
There's also links to our Discord server and anywhere that you can listen to us. Thank you, Chuck, once again for joining us. It's always a pleasure linking up with you and talking about some of these fantastic movies that we've done. Seriously, cannot wait to talk about Scream 4 next week. I think it's going to be a blast.
Oh, man, I always have a blast when I talk with you guys. So, yes, I'm looking forward to doing this again next week, and it's going to be so much fun.
Hell yeah. All right.
All right. Oh, we'll talk to you next week, guys.
See you later.